So that is a good question, is why do we look at Aerosmith as a nostalgia act in a negative way, but we don't throw that same feeling and same title onto AC/DC, who in some ways may be more guilty of it than Aerosmith? Hello and welcome back to the Ear Fuel Podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at The Daily Guru and at Get Ear Fuel. The podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Ear Fuel and at soundcloud.com/GetEarFuel. What you heard at the top was a moment from my recent conversation that I had with one of my favorite contributors here, my pal Christian. He was here in New York City the other week, and we got into a deep, deep conversation about, you know, problems with musical genres, whether nostalgia acts are a bad thing, and tons of other stuff. He and I, as soon as we start going, if there's no one to stop us, we will talk about music for hours. Thankfully, though, about 10 minutes into it, I decided, you know, we should probably record that, and we're going to get into that right after a quick album review. So the album that I want to review this week is the brand new one from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and it's called The Getaway. Now, before we even dig into the record itself, I need to freely admit that for me, we are dealing with a band that I loved. That's L-O-V-E-D, loved, for years. But I feel like they haven't made a listenable album since 1995's One Hot Minute, which I liked a lot. That is to say, once this band started making, you know, pop ballads and singles for well-adjusted tweens, I fell off the Red Hot Chili Peppers love train, and I fell off really, really, really fast. This was one of the most unique and impressive, like, funk-based punk bands ever. And they just seem to get further and further from that sound with every passing record, and they just become more and more mediocre, if not worse, and it really hurts me to see that happening. So it's been 20 years or so since I could really stomach a Chili Peppers record, but I keep checking out their new music every single time because I'm hoping that they'll get back to that old, amazing funk punk sound, or just do something to get me excited again. Onto the record itself. Most significantly, this is the band's first album since 1989's Mother's Milk, where Rick Rubin is not producing. And I'm a big fan of that because as much as I love Rick Rubin and he is a true key part of music history, he's been ruining a lot of great records lately. Most noticeably was a few years back when he destroyed that Gogol Bordello record. He's making everything really, really clean. So getting away from a producer you've been with for a really long time is always a good idea in my book. Instead, this time, we have Danger Mouse, and I was really hoping that a new producer would help breathe new life into them as a band. It's a very long time, really, to keep working with the same person behind the board, so if there was ever a chance for them to find something fresh and get me back into the Chili Peppers, this was it, and I was really excited to hear it. The record starts off, well, you know what? I like the intro. I really did. It's got this great, funky feeling, and there's this tinge of disco on it that works really, really well. I was smiling, hoping that finally, yes, I could dig a new Chili Peppers tune. However, that lasted about 60 seconds, because about a minute into the song, it became obvious that no, this is just going to be more tepid, unadventurous, vanilla music, and it shows the main problem this song that plagues the first few songs, the backing vocals. Now, I can try and get past, and I did get past, the fact that Anthony Kiedis' main vocals are way too out in front of the mix. They're way too far in front, almost the entire record. But the female backing vocals at the beginning, the first three or four songs, they are cringe-worthy bad. And that's odd for me, because anyone who listens knows I tend to adore female vocals wherever they are. I love a female vocalist. But in this case, they really tank the opening few songs. They really do. Now, to their credit, the rhythm section is in top form all across the first half of the album. I hate saying that it's a pleasant surprise because, I mean, they're one of the most talented pairings on earth. You just can't get past that whether you dig the band or not. But it's been a damn long time since I feel like the rhythm section of the Chili Peppers really flexed their chops on a record. And it's honestly nice to hear that again. It really is. I also dig the keyboards and how they work those into the first few songs. But man, the backing vocal, the placement of the lead vocal, I mean, the first song isn't a terrible song, but there's no pop, there's no zing to it, and it gets the record off to a really shaky start. That continues through a majority of the first side. The songs are just lackluster and often extremely heavy-handed, as in the case of the lyrics of Dark Necessities, the first single. We get it. Drugs and all that stuff. We got it. Could you write a better wording for it, please? Really. Aside from the lyrics, the song We Turn Red is damn solid, and I like the swing to it. I will take this song, We Turn Red, as a hope that there is still potential on the record. I'm going to go with that, okay? Well, until, of course, the next song, The Longest Wave, which, honestly, it sounds like they stole a bad Counting Crows melody and tried to make their own cover version of it. Major yawn here, and the song just goes nowhere. Sadly, that is basically what happens the rest of the record. It's uninspired, meh kind of songs that really don't feel very distinct from one another. There was even a point late in the album where I had to check that I didn't accidentally repeat a song because I felt like I'd already heard exactly what they were doing 2, 3, maybe 4 times. It was very disappointing. I did enjoy moments like the first 45 seconds of the song Sick Love, and I know that sounds like such a backhanded compliment, and it kind of is, but the first 45 seconds are great, but then it devolves into this repetitive one-trick song. And while the track Detroit had a ton of potential, the lyrics are eye-rollingly cringeworthy. There's this, oh God, it's like it's amateur hour for them, and this is a band that should be writing much better because they're capable of it. The album Closer is a nice song, but sadly, after all of the garbage before it that you have to settle for, it's really hard to dig in for that song. I can't deny the fact that there were 2 or 3 songs here that I moderately to significantly enjoyed, which hasn't happened at all in a long time with this band. However, this isn't just another record that I'm going to have to add to the Chili Peppers collection of albums that fall light years short of the potential this band once showed. I really have no idea why they decided to stop writing exciting, envelope-pushing music that could make any crowd explode in happiness. But that's clearly the road they've decided to stay on. So if you dug the Chili Peppers of the last decade, you'll probably like this album too. It's more of the same. But if you enjoy that band for the talent and the artistic freedom and power they once showed, just pass on this one. It's just going to make you sad. Moving on, like I said, the other week my buddy Christian was here, and we just talk forever about music if given the chance. And a lot of bands have been kind of talking about how they're getting back together lately, and the last time we talked to Christian, we talked about bands reuniting, and we kind of picked up from there, and, well, you know what? It just turned into a really, really interesting conversation that I did not see coming. So sit back, relax, and get ready to hear some strong opinions. Right. Okay, so I saw this really good documentary the other day. It's called I Dream of Wires, and it's basically about the rise and kind of history of the modular synthesizer. It's one of the nerdier things I've watched, but it was really, really good, starting with, like, you know, all the way back with Robert Moog and Robert Moog. Wow.
Are you talking about the different compartmental synthesizer that Floyd made, you know?
Even, yeah, that would eventually lead to that. Yeah, and then kind of how that led into the synthesizer kind of crazy commercial revolution of the early 80s, where everyone had a synth, and kind of how it works nowadays, which I thought was pretty cool.
Why? Yeah.
It was really good. You should check it out. It's very nerdy.
So many other things that were wrong and whatnot. Synthesizers were one of those things.
Synth pop. Yeah. And it's making that weird comeback that I don't understand. Like, even, you know what, it's been happening for a few years, because when you and I were at Lollapalooza in 2009, there were a bunch of bands there doing the stupid synth rock sound.
I don't get it. What is your opinion, talking about synth or keyboards, what is your opinion of the Killers?
I don't like them. But it has nothing to do with the style, whatever his name is, the front man?
Yes,
really
Brandon
don't
Flowers.
Like his voice. Really don't like his voice.
Is that the only reason?
I think their lyrics are pretty lame. Granted, Mr. Brightside makes me want to stab my ears.
Okay.
But I forgive bands for their singles in general, because a lot of the time, not that they didn't write it, but they didn't choose for a certain song. You know, the A&R guys are the ones who say this is the single.
Mm-hmm.
And so often the single is not representative of the band as a whole. It was that whole movement of bands that happened, you know, the Killers, the Strokes, the Hives, all of them kind of emerged within about 12 months of each other. And that whole scene I just really never got into.
But I was trying to think about...
Get closer to your microphone when you're talking.
I was trying to think about the...
Oh, hi.
Oh, hello. Hello. I was trying to think about the bands of recent years that were on the verge of going from the smaller to mid-sized venues to arena bands, mm-hmm. and could actually have longevity. The most recent one that I can think of is Pearl Jam, Foo Fighters. Those guys have been around for over 20 years now.
They're basically classic rock now. And not in a bad way, meaning, you know, those records are 20 plus years old.
But
not the Foo Fighters record yet.
But is,
actually, no, wait. The Foo Fighters record is over 20 years old now, isn't it?
Does that make it classic rock? Is classic rock bad? I think classic rock has a certain stigma to it that it's, if something is classic rock, mm-hmm. then that band and those musicians have hung it up creatively, and they're just going to ride the coattails of their former albums and their old songs, and they're basically on cruise control creatively, I think is the stigma that a lot of people have, which I don't think is necessarily true, but...
Right, because, you know, the first person that comes to mind is Bruce Springsteen. Because Bruce is certainly considered in classic rock, maybe on the tail end of classic rock, things like Born to Run and Dancing in the Dark and stuff like that, you will find on classic rock stations. And yet, although I don't like him, his recent stuff, he is trying new things musically. You know, from his last few records have been new territory for him. He's not just, you know, making more arena anthems, so to speak.
When I think of classic rock, I think back to the radio station that I used to work at, and classic rock there was Bad Company, Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Those two in the same, right back to back. But right. Still, but it's right. No, it's right. It's a
Blue Oyster Cult, AC/DC. Mm-hmm. That was all, quote unquote, quote, classic rock.
Yeah.
You know, David Bowie was in there too. So when I hear someone say, when you say something along the lines of Pearl Jam and Foo Fighters have been around for over 20 years, now they get shifted over from into the classic rock
mm-hmm.
category, then that makes me think, well, their career's over now.
So to you, classic rock is a specific sound as opposed to once a rock song has reached this age, you know, where, you know, at 60, right, or 65, people become senior citizens. So once a rock album hits a certain age, it does not become classic rock to you. Classic rock is a very specific era.
Yes. There is a radio station, not that I listen to terrestrial radio hardly anymore, but once in a while, I'll just flip it on just for grins.
Uh-huh.
The quote-unquote classic rock station in Columbus played Welcome to the Jungle the other day. And I'm like, whoa. Oh my God, is Appetite for Destruction is now in the classic rock section?
That song's almost 30 years old. That song, Appetite for Destruction, is coming up on 30.
But I don't consider that classic rock.
Because you still see something, jumping back, because it's an easier thing. The first Pearl Jam record, to you, is still a grunge record.
If we have to put that label on it, yes.
As opposed to a classic rock record.
Right, correct. Like I said, and everything, and... Let's go the Sirius XM route.
Okay.
The classic, what's on classic vinyl? Blue Oyster Cult,
mm-hmm.
Bad Company, Zeppelin.
But you have Classic Rewind that has the cassette era stuff. Remember that when you're going to talk Sirius channels, I have to deal with them every day. So.
But you know what I mean?
But you're absolutely right. There's Lithium. Which is just, you know, the 90s grunge and alternative stuff.
Yes.
It is. You're not going to hear Pearl Jam on Rewind or
correct.
Vinyl.
Yeah. Van Halen's classic rock.
So where's the border then? Because, see, I don't put Van Halen in that same group. I don't put something like Jump or Hot for Teacher alongside Whole Lot of Love and Feel Like Making Love.
I think that's one of the big problems that mass-produced radio mm-hmm. and categorization of music has lumped things together that don't necessarily fit together. But because they...
You're just used to it by now.
Yes.
Because to me, you know, I agreed with what you said with, you know, yeah, Bad Company, Zeppelin, all that, you know, a little bit of Stones here and there, you know, sprinkling some other randoms once in a while. But there's a distinct difference then when you get to Van Halen. That is a totally different sound, even earlier Van Halen.
Right.
And I just don't feel, I don't think they're classic rock. Van Halen to me is rock and roll, which yeah. is a ridiculous difference to try and make to say like, no, Led Zeppelin's not rock and roll. You know, Led Zeppelin is hard rock or classic rock. See, and this is something that's always frustrated me. And you and I have had conversations similar to this very, very often, that just labeling things in general, it just becomes so limiting and confining, which I guess is the reason people do label things, to make them easier to organize. But, you know, when people continue to, and I used the term, label Pearl Jam as grunge, I'll let them get away with it. But when someone tries to call either, and these are the easiest two bands to do it with, REM or Smashing Pumpkins alternative rock, I always say to them, I said, but those two bands have nothing in common at all.
Other than they came out, well, no, I mean, REM came out, it started in the 80s, yeah. Pumpkins 90s, because their popular, most popular records apexed in the early 90s.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
And if you want to go for the music labels, what was an alternative to hair metal or, you know, hair bands or cheesy pump or pop music?
Yeah.
At the 80s, you know?
Right.
Is that what alternative really came from? Because I guess if that's the case, I can understand where that's coming from. But as far as, that's like saying Black Sabbath and...
I think I know where you're going with this, a Motorhead type band. Like, they would have been almost alternative rock in the early 70s because they were doing more of a metal sound.
Sure, sure.
So, but what I, you know, and I think that's exactly right. Because then in, what I say with Smashing Pumpkins and REM, though, is you're calling them both the same genre. You're calling them both alternative rock.
Mm-hmm.
But they have no similarities in music aside from them not sounding like what was going on in the mainstream. And what was going on in the mainstream was Nirvana and Pearl Jam and kind of the grunge sound. So it's, you know, you would then have to rightfully give bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam the label of rock music if you're going to refer to the other stuff as alternative rock. These are the sort of things. This is why I always look forward to seeing you, other than the fact that we've been friends for so long, that these are conversations we can entertain and we can go down these rabbit holes and just show all of the problems in the world of music.
First world music problems.
I mean, these really are. How are we going to solve how people label certain things? The better question is actually, now that I'm thinking about it, because we touched on this before we started recording. So Springsteen then, okay? Because Springsteen is making new records that a lot of people are liking, is Springsteen saved from being called a nostalgia act?
How do you measure the impact, or not necessarily, you can't go by sales anymore because Billboard,
completely unfair.
Billboard has changed how they tally up sales of music now.
And buying habits have changed drastically since, like, let's just call it even 1990.
Right. Do you go to music publications, blogs, if you will, podcasts, mm-hmm. where folks...
People listen to podcasts.
They're a waste of time. Where people talk about music, uh-huh. and say, this new album by Bruce Springsteen is strong, it's fresh, it's new material, and how I hate to use the word successful, but sometimes I think commercially, if something is selling, then maybe that is some sort of litmus test to how their new material holds up versus just, let's go to Aerosmith. They put out new material, but it tanked.
And it's horrible.
Okay. So
it's so bad.
So it tanked because it didn't sell well because it was bad. So have there been some albums by established artists lately that have come out that did not sell well but were strong?
Absolutely. Absolutely have been. Well, and see, I think that's only one part of the equation because, you know, if we look at a band like Aerosmith, whose last great record was either Permanent Vacation or Get a Grip, and their last good record was then either Get a Grip or Nine Lives, which was a good record, but not a lot of people checked out the second side. Since then, they've just put out, you know, to quote one of my favorite bands, A Steady Diet of Nothing, just a lot of below mediocre records. And they're, you know, they're going out and they're touring on the, hey, we'll probably play Walk This Way. We're going to play Living on the Edge. We're going to play, you know, Janie's Got a Gun, Love in an Elevator.
Are they doing that because they're at the end of the creative conveyor belt?
Right? I think so. I think musically, if you listen to what they're doing, I think, yeah, they have no new ideas, and it's gotten pretty stale. And they know that if they just showed up and played everything off of A Little South of Sanity or Just Push Play, nobody would go to those shows because nobody wants to hear those songs because they're not very good songs. So they are literally surviving off of this nostalgia of their old music.
So does that lessen your view of them or their impact or their place in music history because they can't come up with anything original and they're riding on the coattails of their previous hits? What's wrong with that? I think there's a stigma of, you know what, we're gonna ride on the old stuff and we're not gonna come up with anything new. A band that was newer, who I think recognized that, you know what, we don't need to play new stuff. We're going to ride on the coattails of our other albums, was Rage Against the Machine.
I was about to say Rage Against the Machine. They're the perfect example.
So despite what they're doing now, that's another conversation with...
Chuck D and Be Real.
Yep.
Yeah.
But they came out with their three albums and they said, you know what, we don't need to come out. The cover albums was fun.
Yeah, Renegades was a fun little record.
It was fun, yeah. But they didn't feel...
But it wasn't a real
Rage. When
did
that come
record.
Out? That was 2002.
Maybe. No, I think it was earlier than that. I want to say it was like 2000. Because I think I was still at Bowling Green. I think I had a Rage Against the Machine Renegades poster on my wall.
It had to be... Well, I think the Battle of Los Angeles came out in like... 98 because
I tragically underappreciated Rage record,
but I remember it because that was one of the first CDs that my roommate Luke burnt on his new computer.
Oh, one of them fancy burners, huh?
And we're like, wow, we can burn and copy compact discs. This
compact
awesome.
Disc players, that's amazing.
But yeah, that was an underrated album. But
it really was.
So if you think about, we saw them at Lollapalooza in 2000 something.
Yeah.
And it came out in 99.
Yeah,
oh my
they
gosh.
Did. Yeah, they did. 99 was Battle of Los Angeles, and then Renegades was the throwaway record because
they had
broken
a contract,
up,
and they had already broken up.
Right, that was a contract fulfillment record.
Yep. So if you think about that, that came out in 99.
Yeah,
we saw them at Lolla in what, 2009?
I thought it was 2007.
Still, a good.
It was about a decade later, and they had done
a
nothing.
Good 8 to 10 years.
Yeah,
they made no new music.
Right,
but they were okay with that. And
well, they were slightly different, and here's why. Because I respect what Rage did, because they broke up, at least what they said to the media and to the world was, they broke up because they felt that they were starting to compromise themselves as artists and that they'd kind of become, quote-unquote, the machine, and you know, they had nothing else to say. And that I really respected when they were like, look, we've you know, it's like The Clash said, you know, if you've been playing for years, we've already heard your song. And that is the difference to me, is that Rage were like, here it is, we did it. Let's call it a day and go our separate ways, where a band like Aerosmith, who, as you know, I loved for a very, very long time, and I still love most of those records, they're kind of beating a dead horse and embarrassing themselves a little bit.
So why is it okay for someone like AC/DC? Mm-hmm. Why do I not think of them in the same light as Aerosmith, as, you know, regurgitating the same stuff? And
because they are,
for the most part, yeah. 90% of their set list is probably
the old stuff. It's the classics, which brings us to the question I want to pose to everybody listening. This was something you and I talked about a little bit ago. So everyone, you can tweet at me, of course, at the Daily Guru and at Get Earfeel Christian. What is your Twitter? I know what your Twitter is.
At CAS CBUS.
Right. Our question is, if you take the Black Album out of the mix, name me one great Brian Johnson era AC/DC record. Anyone, just one great record from beginning to end. And I'm not trying to say Back in Black isn't great, because Back in Black is a hell of a record. But if you take Back in Black out of the mix, post Bon Scott AC/DC is pretty mediocre in the studio.
The sum of all of their albums past that, I can take those albums and I can cherry pick off 2 to 3 songs off of each one that are solid.
Yeah.
And I can make one effing great album.
Right. Yeah. You can swear here, buddy. It's okay.
It's the internet.
Your wife won't yell at you.
I'm afraid.
Right, right. You pull off like, you know, Money Talks and Thunderstruck and was it Ball Breaker or was it called Balls to the Wall or something like that?
No, Big Balls.
Big Ball. No, Big Balls is way early. Big Balls is...
Was that Dirty Deeds?
Yeah. Right. You know, you grab like, Big Gun, which was on the soundtrack to Last Action Hero.
That was a great song.
That was a great song.
That was a great song.
I definitely appreciate it. Really stupidly funny movie. Wasn't meant to be, but... So that is a good question, is why do we look at Aerosmith as a nostalgia act in a negative way, but we don't throw that same feeling and same title onto AC/DC, who in some ways may be more guilty of it than Aerosmith?
I don't know if it's... Okay, here's why. Here's possibly why. The songs that AC/DC play, we know what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
Drinking, having a good time, partying, and ladies.
Yep.
Right? Aerosmith, I think we hold them to maybe a little more higher standard, if you will.
Okay.
As far as like writing or material or maybe the lyrics behind their song.
Dude looks like a lady. Yeah.
But it's not the same. Aerosmith doesn't have the same subject matter in every song.
They're not as I love AC/DC. They're not as sleazy. In a way, like Aerosmith had their point where, you know, they're not as like much of like a bar band. Like, you know, you're just sitting around drinking. Aerosmith is more almost just an arena band.
I don't want to say intellectual, but
I don't know if anyone's ever referred to Aerosmith as, you know, a thinking man's rock band.
They're very ahead of their time.
I know how much you love like really thoughtful rock bands like Rush, you know, real intellectual music.
Very insightful. There's just something... For whatever reason, we hold them to a higher standard.
Okay. Or a different standard.
Yes, different.
Standard. So then if we go back a little bit further, because now we've kind of got two bands that peaked in the late 70s through the 80s and have just been kind of coasting. What about what a lot of people will probably say is the biggest nostalgia band on the planet today, the Rolling Stones, a band who were really, really good in the late 60s and extraordinary in the 70s. And then, I mean, you think about the records they put out after that, like, you know, Steel Wheels, Voodoo Lounge, was it Bridges to Babylon was in there. And it's just been a lot of heavy stink. Not that there wasn't a decent track here and there, but I don't think most people could have named all three of those records. And I think there's more that I just can't remember. I'm sure the Stones have put out some more. But what do you do with a band like that who, I'm telling you, if you go see them live, it's an amazing show. I saw the Stones recently in the last few years, and they are still... a hell of a rock and roll band, even Mick, though Mick is like, what, 650? But they're just doing the hits. You know, they're going to do, you know, Satisfaction, Paint It Black, Street Fighting Man, stuff like that.
Why do they feel the need to try to put out a record of new material?
Do they need to?
I think they feel the need because I think they don't want to lapse back into, we are a nostalgia act, and I think their get-out-of-jail-free card is, hey, look, we're putting out a new album. We're not resting on our laurels, if you will. We're going to push forward. We're going to put out new material so we are still, quote-unquote, relevant. We still have creative juices left in the tank.
Well, maybe it's not creative juices, but performance juices, because my question then is this, and maybe this is the core of what we're trying to get to. Is the label of a nostalgia band always a bad thing?
I think nostalgia band to me carries with it some sort of a negative connotation of I'm going to see this band at the state fair. You know who a nostalgia band is? Cheap Trick.
Okay. Who just got put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame against my best wishes. But I'll tell you, they didn't ask me. Don't know why. They didn't ask me.
They should have.
Yeah, right?
But they are a nostalgia band, but I don't think in a bad way.
Okay, maybe nostalgia isn't necessarily a bad thing when you step back and look at it. Everybody says it in a negative way, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing.
It could be. I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. With Cheap Trick, you know what you're going to get. Cheap Trick and AC/DC in this context could be in the same bucket as nostalgia band is okay.
Okay.
Even though Cheap Trick hasn't released anything new, AC/DC has.
Would you put Kiss into that same group? Because Kiss has been doing the same damn thing for 30 years.
But they've been releasing new music, and Gene Simmons will tell you that...
Gene Simmons will tell me all sorts of crap that I'm not going to listen to.
He will tell you that they are still relevant because they're still making new music, and they're the reason rock and roll is alive.
Well, I mean, look, God gave rock and roll to you, right?
They certainly did.
The Big Bill and Ted hit. Man, we are on like obscure movie soundtrack run here.
Ooh.
Yeah. Anyway.
I'm going to keep trying to think some more.
Do you want to be a singer? Oh, play guitar. Yeah, I know the song.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love those movies. Anyway, moving on.
Circle back.
Focus.
So Kiss has been doing that.
Uh-huh. So you don't think Kiss is a nostalgia band?
I do.
Okay. But not in a negative way. Because you're saying from this, if someone is putting out new music, if someone's continuing to put out new music, then they are not a nostalgia band.
Oof.
Or not a nostalgia band in a bad way. Because like you look at a group like conversely, let's look at it. I named it earlier. Someone like the Beach Boys, who haven't put out a record in a very, very long time, and obviously there's multiple bands touring under the name of the Beach Boys, but they're still basically playing the songs that were written, say, you know, 65 through 70. That's what they're playing live.
Here's nostalgia bands. Heart.
Okay.
They haven't put out anything new. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not the biggest Heart fan.
What about Joan Jett?
No, Joan Jett just did a record like a year and a half ago, and I actually liked it.
Okay.
Not to slam Joan Jett, like it's weird that Joan Jett. But she just did a new record. I forget the name of it, but it was good. And she's on like Warp Tour every year now.
Okay.
Joan Jett's still a total badass.
Journey.
They have a new singer though, right? I think Steve Perry's been gone for a while.
Still.
Uh-huh.
Journey's nostalgia act.
Okay. What about like when Motley Crue did their residency in Vegas?
Motley Crue.
I'm trapping you with this question, buddy, just so you know.
Motley Crue, Kiss, AC/DC all fall into, and Rolling Stones all fall into that. They're trying to stay relevant. I just read something. I thought it was interesting. Tommy Lee even mentioned that one of the reasons he thinks they called it quits is because they did run out of creative juices.
Mm-hmm. And they just got bored doing the same thing.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
He kept saying that he kept trying to push things in a different way. And I'd believe it, right? He did like Methods of Mayhem.
Yeah. Ugh.
But hey,
it was different. It was a different thing and he tried it.
I appreciate that he was trying to do something different.
Uh-huh.
Good or bad. You know, he's trying to say, I'm not just a drummer and I'm going to do something else. Not a lot of other bands or people would step out of their, current
successful
job
thing that they're doing. Yeah.
But yeah, Motley, AC/DC, Kiss,
uh-huh.
Rolling Stones.
There's others, obviously.
Yeah. But they are all trying to stay, they were all trying to stay relevant by releasing new things.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really put one of their, let's say within the past 10, 15 years,
mm-hmm.
albums that were really like, whoa,
right.
That was awesome.
Well, and it's what, you know, I said this to you a while ago, is that I got a lot of heat for it when right after he passed away, I was saying, you know, I think there are more bad David Bowie records than good David Bowie records. Because over the last, let's just call it 20 years, the last 20 years of his life, he really didn't make, he made one or two good songs here and there. And he was experimenting big time with sounds, and I still haven't bought into the whole Black Star craze. I think it's a good record. I still don't think it's a great record, in fact. Anyway.
But do you think it was solid enough that it wasn't a, you know, two good songs and the rest is filler?
Oh, no. I think it's solid from beginning to end, and I kept respecting Bowie because he kept trying new things. Like when he did the record with Trent Reznor, you know, which
that was a good album.
Which, right.
Earthling,
yeah, with I'm Afraid of Americans on it.
That was a good album.
It was a cool record. And then he did the whole tour. That was one of the best shows I ever saw.
So why
in my
is
life.
It okay? And why do you not consider Bowie a nostalgia artist in a bad way when all those other bands that we just mentioned, there's some sort of negative connotation mm-hmm. to what they're doing, even though they're making new stuff? Because it's the same thing. And Bowie was trying different things. So that was cool. And that's. So he's exempt from being bad nostalgia?
I think maybe it's this, because I won't say Bowie was completely not a nostalgia act, which is a butchering of the English language. I apologize. I saw him...
He didn't... He wasn't, because he was not totally negative nostalgia,
uh-huh.
because he didn't go back and do the whole Ziggy persona.
Sure,
if he came out and did that every night, then I would say he's resting on those coattails, and he's writing that.
Right, and that's exactly it. Like, you know, he did the Ziggy Stardust character for a while. And then he was like, and he's, you know, I mean, there were a lot of psychological things going on there, but then he finished that character and he did the Thin White Duke era, where he was like, here's how I'm going to create now. And, you know, and by the time you get to the mid-90s, I mean, like I said, I saw the Nine Inch Nails David Bowie tour further down the spiral or something like that. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. And Bowie was, at the time, he was reinventing his old songs. Like, he was kind of like taking, and I don't remember much specifically, I was a little stoned. He was taking songs from the 70s, and he was working them with the band that he had on stage with him in the 90s, so the sound had to evolve in some way. And I think that, to me, is the difference, is that as an artist, he was evolving, where with the Stones, they're still going in and kind of making more and more mediocre blues-based rock and roll songs. You know, they're not, I don't see them growing as musicians, and it doesn't mean, and you don't have to be a long-standing act to have that problem. I'll talk about that, you know, in a lot of the reviews I do, where I'm like, that band isn't showing me anything new.
Okay.
It's like Tool. I'm going to go after them. It's like Tool, because Tool, as we've talked about here on the podcast before, all of their records are basically variations on the same idea. And I know all the Tool fanboys are going to be like, no, all those albums are complete genius. I love Tool. But the reality is, you can interchange most of their songs, at least everything past Undertow. You can interchange most of those songs onto any other album and they'll still fit.
Along that same argument, Slayer.
Yeah.
I've just come to the realization, are a majority of the bands that we love all nostalgia acts?
I think so. To a certain extent, yeah, because they haven't made quality music in a decade. I think the exceptions to that would be a lot of the bands that aren't as old. I think Pearl Jam is still very relevant. I think the last record, Lightning Bolt, I think that was a hell of a record. And you could feel new energy in there. And I know a lot of people didn't really like it. That is the last Pearl Jam record I enjoyed that much was probably Yield. And as much as everyone likes to shit on Dave Grohl, I think the Foo Fighters are still, they're still trying. And I think it's part of why Dave Grohl keeps putting that band on hiatus, is because he's going to try and find other creative things to do. And maybe, you know, it's not his only gig, and he knows that. So I think the problem we're having most here with everything that's going on is defining...
We're having... No. This is... I just realized what it is. Mm-hmm. We are having issues with us turning older. Well, and the...
I'm still 16 and young and sprightly.
This is what's going on. We're approaching pre-midlife crises.
I've already had two.
And
the first was the YouTube series. This podcast is my second.
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. No, I think there's that. And combined with the fact that defining what a nostalgia act is and allowing the term nostalgia act to be an okay thing, like that you can be a nostalgia act, but that's, you know, it's still a great show or something like that. And I think those are the sticking points that as a society, we, you and I, need to help people move on from.
We're here to help.
It's all we're ever here to do, and talk about music. As always, my thanks to Christian for, my thanks to Christian for always bringing up great conversation when it comes to music. Hit me up on Twitter at GetEarFuel and @TheDailyGuru, and let me know your thoughts on nostalgia acts, good or bad. Before we call it a week, though, I do, of course, have your weekly Earfuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the idea that these days music has been largely relegated to a background task for most people. You're driving, you're at work, you're on the subway, you're at the gym, whatever. And the listening assignment is about consciously listening to music for the sake of the music alone. This week, inspired by their brief mention in our conversation, your assignment is Motorhead's indispensable 1980 album, Ace of Spades. First off, if you don't know Motorhead, they are one of the finest and most important bands in terms of that line between hard rock and heavy metal. You can make the case for both, you know, them being a hard rock band and them being a heavy metal band. And regardless, they're a kick-ass killer band that were fronted by the legendary late Lemmy Kilmister. The Ace of Spades album, it's as high octane as it is rocking. And much of the reason this record stands far beyond the rest of their catalog was that they'd finally found the producer who could capture their live show sound and spirit within the confines of a studio. That's what really makes this album so special. It explodes out of the speakers, and it never takes a breath, delivering a dozen perfect tracks in just over a half hour. From the second the album kicks off with the iconic title track, you know that song, and you understand why Motorhead's sound can never be mistaken for any other, as each instrument screams across the song with all the space it needs. That's the key here. The instruments never encroach on one another, allowing for just, it's just a massive wall of rock majesty. They careen around corners, making it impossible not to rock out with an air guitar, or maybe get your fists in the air, maybe a one-man mosh pit if you really get into it, which you should. Every song here just refuses to be ignored in the best way possible, and even if you've never heard Motorhead beyond the single, this album is going to make you fall in love with them right away. Seriously. New levels of home stereos had to be created for this album so it could be played loudly enough. Not true. And honestly, I'm not sure if you can play it loudly enough. Very true. Lemmy's bass work is ridiculously good, and it's the way it slams into the flying guitar work of Eddie Clark. Music magic at its best, really, and that's in no way to forget about their drummer, Filthy Phil Taylor. The guy is unrelenting, and when you consider the sound and energy they're able to create with just three players, it's a little bit insane, in a good way. I also love the fact that this band has no need to be subtle with their song titles. Songs like The Chase is Better Than the Catch, Fast and Loose, and of course, Jailbait. I mean, come on. They're just awesome, and they're exactly what you'd expect them to be. And you also can't overlook the road anthem, We Are the Road Crew, one of the best songs ever. Love Me Like a Reptile Never Ages. I mean, really, there is not a bad song anywhere on here, and these tracks get better and better every time you spin it. Along with all of that, it goes without saying that there is nobody else out there in history who sounded like Lemmy, and that gritty, raspy delivery he brings with just the right amount of attitude and aggression, it's just that raw, unapologetic sound that makes these songs so exceptional. It's that balance between edgy darkness and like fist and horns in the air, beer glass clanking party that makes the music of Motorhead impossible not to love. And come on, they have an umlaut in their name. I mean, that is as rock and roll as it gets. We have an umlaut. If there were ever an album that is as much about the spirit of the songs as it is the sentiment and sound, it is the entirety of the Ace of Spades record. I mean, I can't even talk about it without rocking out while I'm talking about it. That is how great an album it is. It is hard rock perfection, any way you slice it. And if you don't already blast this one on a weekly basis, you need to change that right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. You can find me on Twitter at @GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. Now, there will be no podcast next week. And, you know, the last few months, there have been some missed weeks here and there. And I have to let you all know why. I'm getting married next weekend. So like has happened a number of weeks over the past few months where there hasn't been a podcast, I'm going to be a little bit busy, I guess you could say, and probably won't have time to do a new podcast. But once I get back, we will be back on every single week. So that's why I will have disappeared. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel and at soundcloud.com/getearfuel. And hey, if you dig what we do here, do me a favor, go tell a friend or three, all right? That is your weekly Earfuel. Share and enjoy.